This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What makes a house a home? Ask Tom Berry. He's an architect and a professor at North Carolina State University, and he studied the question for years. In his new book, House and Home, Cultural Context, Ontological Roles, Berry explores our innate and intimate need to find spaces to call home. And his research into the past gives him insight into the problems we face today with a shortage of affordable housing and the difficulties caused by gentrification. Tom Berry directs the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Initiatives at NC State, and he joins me now on The State of Things. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Tell us a little bit about this. I mean, we think, you know, of sort of this most natural thing and most basic need to build shelter, but it was not always thus. The way we live today, particularly in America, and shelter ourselves is not the way humans have even thought about their housing and their dwelling in the deep, dark past, eh?
That's right. Well, when we think about our homes, we often think about our houses. And a house, of course, is a very, you know, place-based type thing. But home is a place-less idea, and it's something that takes on and incorporates many different aspects of the human condition. And essentially, where I start with the book is talking about the perennial quest to find or make a home in the world, to find our place in the world and to be able to call it ours.
And this does obviously have some kind of an architectural context to it, the way in which we shelter ourselves. But again, if you think about the way we live so isolated now, tend to live that way. Certainly suburban living has allowed us to live in a very isolated way. It brings into sharp relief this difference between house and home, right? Because home would be where, if you didn't live in that kind of a world, if you lived in a world where your community was your home, the people around you were vital to you, and yeah, we should probably get a roof over our heads, right?
Yeah, that's right. And homes where people lived, our ancestors or, you know, folks from other cultures, including Native American cultures, where they lived was deeply embedded in both their culture and their environment. The Navajo have a wonderful myth called the Blessing Way myth, in which their hogans were actually given to them by their god. And the hogan replicated their environment while also creating what we call a microcosm of that environment. And so in that way, their whole lives were in a circle which talked about the completeness and embeddedness of where they lived.
And it's kind of interesting to think about those populations that exist outside of what we consider modern life in these kind of European and American climes. You can't imagine that homelessness was ever a problem, even though we wouldn't say that those people had a lot of money.
Well, the interesting thing is that homelessness, and we understand this, is a deeply terrifying thing in our culture, and a very real problem as well. Mm-hmm. Philosophically, in other cultures, homelessness had its virtues. The Buddha talked about giving up your household. In fact, he talked about enlightenment as the smashing of the rafters of your house. And in traditional societies, the shaman, right, mm-hmm. the seer, the healer, was a homeless person because they inhabited a much larger universe.
That's fascinating. How is that different from the way we view things today in general? Housing, shelter, and homelessness. What's different about us, and how did we get to this place?
Well, there's a number of things that come together in American culture, I think, regarding finding a home in the world and homelessness. First of all, in the Western literary tradition, there's a lot of examples where writers take on the modern alienation. You know, modernism, modernity, really in many parts, in many aspects, is about being homeless, of being disconnected from a world that has changed around you, which you no longer recognize. Our very own North Carolina Thomas Wolfe, of course, coined that ubiquitous phrase, you can't go home again. And that's what he was taking on, a way, how can we find our way in this world?
And really, the novel itself, in many ways, is a form that is about traveling as homeless. I mean, if you think about some of the quintessential novels, Huckleberry Finn and others, they're travel novels that bisect a planet or bisect a globe and have a homeless traveler looking for their place, having been either rejected or never been part of.
Oh, yeah. And you go back to Homer and the Odyssey. Odysseus is effectively homeless for 10 years. And there's this beautiful scene where Calypso finally releases him from, you know, his lovely entrapment. But then he's shipwrecked. And when he comes to on the shore, a maiden finds him. And his classic line is, "There is no place in this world like a happy, peaceful home." You know, thinking of his life, Penelope back in Ithaca.
Of course, you know, the day after he gets home and finally gets back to his bed, what does he do but take off again? But that's another story for another time. But it's true. And so this notion of home is so varied in many ways and often, again, connected to the people around us, that the connection. I mean, what happens when Ulysses leaves the home? Everything falls apart. All of the rules of behavior fall apart,
yes.
Right? I mean, the guests stay for far too long.
The suitors.
This violates all the rules of hospitality. So everything falls apart when the home is broken, right? And
yeah.
When the home falls apart. And this is what we're seeing in our own communities now. For people who fall into homelessness, the way back is nearly impossible. There's no place to take a shower to do a job interview. You can't have an address to send your resumes back or to your now you can get a phone, I suppose. At one point you needed a fixed phone. But this really does create a great divide once you fall into this category of homelessness in a way that other forms of poverty may not be so evident.
It's something that I think about all the time. I mean, I think a lot of my scholarship and my work at NC State, at the School of Architecture and the College of Design, is really based on compassion, the knowledge, the direct knowledge that too many of our fellow countrymen are living in substandard housing, dangerous housing, or are one paycheck away from becoming homeless or are in fact homeless. And I have to think, I've never experienced it, I have to think that experience of being homeless must be one of the most disorienting, disturbing things that a human being can experience.
To what extent is the way that we've structured our housing responsible for that? The fact that we can't intimately know the pain of someone who is in a way that other villages and communities, if you live in a hogan, if you live in a longhouse, you're pretty much aware of what everybody else is feeling. If I've got a nice little home all to myself with a garage door that goes down with the push of a button, I may not have to know.
Yeah, that's right. So much of our cultural notions around where we live and how we live are based on, it's kind of an inordinate emphasis on control, on feeling like we need to control our environments. And the first suburbs in America really can be traced back to the first suburbs in England, which were really formed by religious groups initially and conceived as places where one could choose one's neighbors and one could live with like-minded individuals. And we really see that in the way that we build our suburbs now. And Raleigh is, you look around Raleigh, the Durham Triangle, and you can really see those patterns of homogeneous communities and inordinate emphasis on privacy and control.
What, and of course, the fact that we own the property, and this is basically our biggest investment for a middle-class homeowner, that's your retirement fund, right?
It is. We pour so much of both economic concerns, but also psychological and personal ones. The house has been called the third skin. It's a way that we embody and express ourselves. And such that, you know, with all of these factors, and, you know, we've just mentioned a couple, when one feels that their house is threatened, it's very easy to feel personally attacked. And that's why public meetings and issues around housing and homes can be so difficult and contentious.
No, that second skin acts like a suit of armor when it comes to feeling the pain of people around you who aren't so fortunate. So let's talk about those solutions and why they're so difficult. What are some of the possibilities? Obviously, it's preposterous now. You know, Wall Street is soaring. We're headed for a giant crash. But the fact is, in this moment, there it is again. And yet, people are living without homes, and we're hearing that there is a lack of affordable housing. What is going on here? Why is that even true in this society? And then what do you do about it? What can we possibly do to make that better?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why our housing needs continue to grow. And they can be traced back to the fact that the federal government basically got out of public housing and placed that money in the state's hands. Most of our affordable housing is built through low-income housing tax credits. And it's not the best way to do it. And if you just look at Raleigh and Wake County, the amount of need of affordable units has grown substantially over the past 10 years and continues to grow. So how do we deal with it? First, we have to start with our hearts. We have to truly and deeply care about our cities and everybody who lives in them.
If we cared, what would we do? What would happen next?
Well, first of all, there's commitment, and there are a lot of people who are committed to advocating and building affordable housing. But we need everybody at the table, including our elected officials. It's not that government, it's quotes, is going to do it all. Really, the way to do it is through public-private partnerships. There's a lot of good models out there, which over at the college we research.
Well, let's talk about one of them. How would that work? What does that look like? That partnership?
Well, I'll tell you, we ran a project about a year ago. We worked, this was in Raleigh. We partnered with the Visual Artist Exchange. We had other participants in the project from Raleigh Arts Council, from ArtSpace, and so forth. And this is about affordable artist housing. Because on one hand, we hear Raleigh often presented as a growing arts community, a vibrant cultural center, and yet artists need places to live as well, and they need to live close to where their art is going to be shown and produced and so forth. And so we looked at what Raleigh could do, and we looked at models. So this is what we do over at the college. We're in the business of education, and so we're all about providing useful and applicable models. One we discovered is in Pittsburgh. It's a place called Brew House. Artists had been squatting there. They organized. They partnered with the city. The city put money into the project. They also partnered with other organizations. They got low-income housing credits. I think you can see the picture.
Yeah.
There was commitment, there was innovation in how they put it together, and it happened.
Yeah, but the arts sector is the first step in gentrification, right? So they move in, then the hipsters say, that's a cool place, then they move in, and houses that were $90,000 go for $500,000, and all the neighbors around them who had gone begging for a long time for police protection, for better lighting, for better sidewalks, suddenly all that gets done and they get pushed out.
And one of the reasons why it's there is such instability like that, and then the fears underneath it, is because there's not redundancy or diversity in our housing stock. What we need is what we're talking about now is the missing middle. Something between the single-family house in the suburbs and the multifamily house out on the arterial road.
So I'm going to talk about this. This is modest income housing. These would be houses that people could afford, working people, teachers, police officers, that sort of thing, so we can keep them in our cities. We don't make a move to the suburbs, that kind of thing. And even people say doing, working fast food, this kind of thing. So suppose why can't we build a house for $120,000? If you say we need it, why hasn't the market responded with a developer who says, that's my niche?
Well, you actually can buy fairly cheap single-family houses, but they're cheap, and you're going to pay a lot of money for your transportation because they're in ex-urban locations. Now, that's not a diverse form of housing. Right. One thing we've been looking at are accessory dwelling units, so-called granny flats. Here you have housing that's going to be of necessity by code small, mm-hmm. so it's going to be cheaper to build. It's going to be cheaper if you choose to rent it. It can fit into your existing infrastructure, which adds greater density, or what I like to call coziness, which supports other services in the city, including public transportation.
You got a problem here because the neighbors don't always want to see that kind of density. If they moved into a neighborhood expecting one thing, and you put these little houses in, all of a sudden, there's some pushback, is there not?
Well, there has been in Raleigh, which has been a little bit surprising because all of the major cities in North Carolina actually allow accessory dwelling units by right, meaning without restriction other than normal zoning code restrictions of height and setback and so forth. City Council's working on it. Mayor McFarland is committed to them. She's publicly stated her support for them. But it's challenging. And I think it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, is the cultural predilection towards worries around privacy and control of one's living environment. This fear that others, that strangers will move in, that they will disrupt your privacy, all of which, of course, is unfounded.
Well, and that the presence of these units, if they came in any great numbers, could devalue my property. Others might find my house now less attractive because you've allowed this to happen. Again, it may be a fantasy, but if it's in your mind, it's something you push back against.
And that's where I think research comes in, and in gaining both historical perspective and up-to-date case studies. Because, you know, historically we can see culturally that fear that, you know, my house is going to lose value. This is going to really affect my life. Well, studies have shown actually that property values go up when you build these accessory dwelling units, right? There's your facts right mm-hmm. there. And that if they weren't working, if somehow these concerns were actually, were true, then why would cities across the country be adopting ordinances to allow accessory dwelling units and, after a few years, making them easier to build? That, to us, are facts that we can depend on.
I'd also heard that in the building industry, it's tough to build that modest income housing or that modest level because the boom and bust, the nature of the building industry is such that you really need high margins going in so that to be constructing these sort of lower rent or lower priced houses is not a good investment for construction companies, for developers.
Well, that's true, and that's where public-private partnerships come in. So that, everybody has a piece of the stake, but aren't fully responsible for the entire project. You build in, partnerships. Everybody's doing their fair share, and nobody is at undue risk.
Tom Berry is a scholar of architecture, the author of the book House and Home, Cultural Context, Ontological Roles, also a professor and the director of the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Initiative at NC State. And you can find links to his work at our website, stateofthings.org. By the way, Tom's going to be talking about his work at Quail Ridge Bookstore in Raleigh on February 4th and Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville on February 6th. We've got that at our website as well. Tom, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The State of Things, it's music time. Melissa Darrow Engelman is next. Stay tuned.